Good morning. Open the Senate Revenue Committee, and we're going to do SJR 2 first and send that along, and then get back to 6:39 where we left off yesterday. Open a work session on SJR 2. Paul Warner.
Mr. Chair, SJR 2 was part of your series of bills that you looked at for reserve funds. It just makes one change to the current Education Stability Fund. It raises the cap from 5% to 10% of revenue for the state's general fund during the prior biennium. As you recall, with Senate Bill 841 that set aside a portion of the ending balance under our trend projections, we think we'll be at the 5% cap and exceed that by 2000, by the January-February deposit in 2010. So if you bump that to 10%, you would buy at least an additional 4 years in all likelihood. So that would, again, assuming we have no recession between now and 2014, it would be roughly 2014 before we would anticipate hitting a 10% cap.
Senator Starr.
Yes, Senator. I think this is a wise decision to raise this limit, and so I would move Senate Joint Resolution 2 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved SJR 2, which complements our other statutory building of the state's reserve funds bills, for a May election. Any discussion on that motion? Any objection to that motion? So ordered. And I think that's Senator Schrader's bill, so he will carry that bill. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 639, and before we get back into our testimony, we have a dash 5 amendments, which I'll let Steve talk about, but my understanding is that it's just a compilation of the 2s, 3s, and 4s into one amendment.
Yes, correct, Mr. Chair. You have the dash 5 amendment. If you try to compare the 2s, 3s, and 4s, the dash 5s are not in the same order as the 2s, 3s, and 4s, but all of the content is there. And so it's the same material as was talked about yesterday individually. So that the one change where there was conflict between the 2s, 3s, and 4s, I believe it was only in Section 19 where one amendment had a July, still had the July 1 effective date, and the dash 4s changed that, I believe, to October, and so October is in the dash 5.
Any questions for Steve just on the amendments, the 2s, the 3s, and 4s, which are now the 5s? Okay, so let's get back into, let's start with Trisha Smith, Ms. Kathy Spiegel, and Ms. Kim Baudino.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Trisha Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. OSEA represents 20,000 professionals working in Oregon's Head Start, Community College, K-12, ESDs, park and recreation agencies, and libraries. We are the teachers and classified in our schools all over the state. I'm here today to offer our strong support for Senate Bill 639 with the dash 5 amendments. You heard testimony yesterday about the effect of skyrocketing inflation in health care insurance premiums. and how that has affected school districts and their employees. For many OSCA members, the additional costs of their health insurance premiums, deductibles, and copays have become more than they can bear. They now have to choose between groceries and health care, and many of them have chosen to drop their health care because they cannot afford these costs. When employees are forced to either drop health care and become uninsured or cut the food budget, that is not a good choice for Oregonians. Of course, becoming uninsured doesn't mean that these people will not get sick. As an article in the Statesman Journal today said, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has found that 618,000 Oregonians are now uninsured. Some of those people are school employees working in your schools today because they can't afford the premiums and the copays and the deductibles for their health insurance any longer. The longer we delay in passing Senate Bill 639 or something like it, the more school employees will be added to those ranks of uninsured. When that happens, that's not good for employers, employees, or the state because, as I said, they don't disappear. They just get more expensive. As the article today stated, what happens when employees and others don't have health care is they delay treatment when they get sick. When they delay treatment, it costs more, creates more complications, more absenteeism, less productivity at work. And when they seek treatment, they seek it in the emergency room. And that adds to insurance premium costs that we all pay. It's a spiraling downward situation that we need to do everything we can to stop. Senate Bill 639 helps us by eliminating unnecessary, duplicative, and burdensome fixed costs from our health care system. That's what it does. It allows us to pool ourselves together into the largest pool possible with the greatest buying power. That can only save the state and school districts and employees money. And delay, perhaps not for everyone, but delay that inevitability that exists in the current system that many, many more school employees will join the ranks of the uninsured. OSCA supports 639 because it provides school employees and employers the greatest buying power when purchasing health insurance and eliminates unnecessary fixed costs, as I said. I'd like to take a moment to address some of the issues that the opponents of Senate Bill 639 brought to your attention yesterday. They indicated that 639 does nothing to deal with what they consider to be the real cost drivers in health insurance inflation. They mentioned that those cost drivers are aging employees, prescription drug cost inflation, expensive medical procedures, and escalating hospital and physician fees. We believe that actually 639 will create a health insurance delivery system in which these cost drivers can be better addressed than they are in our current piecemeal system. As Mr. Carlson noted in his testimony, not only would the new system save an estimated $182 million over the first 5 years of implementation through reduced administrative costs through economies of scale, but it will also provide better opportunities to reduce other costs by instituting programs on a statewide basis, such as discount prescription drug programs and wellness programs that would reach all employees. According to experts, hospitals, including the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, today, and as they were reported today in the press, hospital and physician fees are increasing with the number of uninsured. The quickest way to curb those costs is to make sure that the greatest number of Oregonians possible are insured. Senate Bill 639 will do that for school employees. Most insurance plans today restrict the usage of high-tech procedures to those instances when less expensive treatment options have already been tried without success or some other specific pre-approved reason. There's no reason to believe that that practice would not continue in the new system created by Senate Bill 639. And lastly, aging employees is listed by opponents as the top reason health care costs are rising. I guess we have to admit we're aging. America's aging. I think that may be the result of widespread access to health care, that we're aging. We don't think that's a bad thing. The issue is how well we age, and do we age well? Health care improves our chances of aging in a healthy way rather than a sick way. And Senate Bill 639 will help us maintain our health and our jobs, and that can help our employers as well as ourselves. Another argument. School districts already have mechanisms for controlling costs. Those mechanisms mentioned were the ones that are driving our members away from the possibility of health insurance. Rising copays, caps on employer premium contribution, higher deductibles. These are the things that are driving my members out of the insurance plans. These solutions don't do anything to reduce the cost of health care. They merely shift those costs to employees, forcing more and more into the ranks of uninsured. That costs us all. Senate Bill 639 offers better options for reducing costs by providing savings that do not reduce access to employees. Another argument was that replacing marketplace competition with a government-run monopoly will increase health insurance costs. In thinking about this, this assertion seems more political rhetoric than fact, and doesn't make sense when you consider that the Oregon Education Benefit Board will not be a monopoly, but will merely be acting as an agent negotiating a range of benefit plans for school districts and their employees, using the increased buying power the large pool will provide and reduced fixed costs system-wide that have been mentioned already. By virtue of its size and purchasing power, OEB will find it easier to contract for certain aspects of service and plan administration with specialty vendors, again, keeping costs as low as possible. Another argument, health insurance costs for most school districts would increase. The numbers offered to you by OSBA we believe to be misleading. It's very difficult to create an average rate for school employees in the current system. To understand, as the testimony said yesterday, that premium costs range from the $600 range to well over $1,000. And the issue here is that double-digit inflation will continue if nothing changes. The last argument I want to address is that cost savings are unsubstantiated. We would not suggest to you to spend $500,000 to substantiate what your common sense tells you to be true, and that is that in this marketplace, bigger is better. Having more employees in our pool, having all our employees in our pool, will reduce unnecessary costs to the system, to you, to us all, and provide more access to health care to school employees than they currently have. I hope that you will pass this bill and the Dash 5 amendments along today, and if I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
My name is Kimberly Fondino. I'm a Spanish teacher at Lebanon High School. I've been there for 10 years, and I'm the president of the local association.
I should have said buenos dias.
Buenos dias. The catch-22 of the state budgetary issue kind of is a conundrum for all of us. As we know, the cost of quality health care is one of the problems we have, but the effects are so much more far-reaching. It's kind of a catch-22. The state funding decreases to the districts. The districts can't afford the insurance increase in the insurance premium. The districts decrease take-home pay or eliminate employees, which has a greater impact when you factor in inflation. Public employee ability to contribute to the economy decreases. Businesses suffer. Employees are laid off. And due to our high dependence on the income tax, state revenue decreases, which puts us back at step number one. When you take the purchasing power away from your public employees, it limits money that is put back into the economy, which slows down economic growth. The effect of this issue is so far-reaching, and health care is just a part of it. An additional negative impact of all of these things is that public service begins to look less and less attractive and less a viable option, and individuals realize they could make significantly more in the private sector. The issue at hand is insurance cost. The main concern of the employees is not so much cost as coverage. The main concern for the state is, of course, cost. How do we balance the interests? Well, Lebanon is a small district. I have about 201 what we call full-time equivalent employees who are certified. That would be the teachers and certified employees. In the last 10 years, we have lost almost 90 teachers. Our teacher turnover was 20% this year alone. We lost our early retirement 2 years ago. Bargaining gets uglier, and public opinion of teachers and schools and public officials becomes negative. Teachers also have had increased requirements in order to keep their licenses. They now have to go to school during the summer, kind of buy their summers. They no longer, it's more of a cost to them that way. And our insurance went from full coverage that was paid by the district to almost $200 out of pocket for individuals. And we've had to increase our deductibles and co-pays. And because OSBA removed the HMO as a possibility, we had to adapt by increasing our co-pays and our deductibles in order to offset the costs and keep it feasible this year. What we need to remember is that regardless of whether the employer or the employee is paying the bill, the state has to come up with the money, either in salary or benefits. We must decrease the overall cost of health insurance for the taxpayers of Oregon. With every district bargaining separately, the carriers can divide, conquer, and make a profit at taxpayer expense. The state needs to come up with a statewide pool that can effectively lower the cost all around. Our current plan, which is the third page of my attachment that just shows the three different options we have, a Plan A, which was a $100 deductible, Plan C, which was a $500 deductible, and the PPO plans. You can see that at the bottom, the teacher out-of-pocket cost, it ranges from $32 for what we consider a secondary option. If your husband or wife is already insured, you could do this option and still have decent health care. But most people run from $160 out-of-pocket to $196 out-of-pocket each month from their salaries. My husband and I have four children. My husband is double covered, but because it was over $100 per month per person to insure our family, that was well beyond our ability to pay. We simply cannot afford double coverage. Our maximum out-of-pocket costs are about $2,500 for medical and $5,000 for prescriptions. Fortunately, we do not reach those maximums, but if we were to need to, it would be very difficult. We already pay $1,920 out-of-pocket this year for my out-of-pocket expenses. But what's truly disturbing is that if you take only the district contribution of $8,160 and my out-of-pocket premium of $1,927, my annual cost of health insurance minimum to the state of Oregon just for me and my family is $10,087 a year. This information doesn't even include the $15 copays every time we need to go or every time one of us needs to visit the doctor, nor does it include the deductibles that we pay. If you multiply that amount times the number of school employees in Oregon, the numbers are staggering. Right now, money is going to the insurance companies. How much of that money stays in Oregon? Remember, the money I don't spend on health care is money that I could contribute to the rest of the economy in Oregon. With only 201 certified FTE, our little local does not have enough power to or incentive to require real fiscal savings from the insurance agencies. There are approximately 60,000 public school employees in Oregon, excluding community colleges. That is a force to reckon with. My conclusions are as such. If public employees have more money to spend on goods and services, there is a multiplier effect that helps the economy grow. Public employees no longer enjoy the benefits that made it acceptable to pay them less, which has led to high turnover and less interest in public sector positions by qualified individuals. Our mutual concerns right now are cost and coverage of health insurance. A statewide pool would give us the bargaining power to make demands on the system in place for efficiency and lower cost. The pool management must be charged with fiscal efficiency balanced with good coverage. And creating a statewide health insurance pool, purchasing pool would provide a cost-effective way to deal with insurance while maintaining quality coverage for the employees. Thank you very much for your time.
Chairman Beckert and members of the committee, my name is Kathy Spagel. I'm an educator in the state of Oregon. I teach 7th grade language arts at North Marion, and I'm much more comfortable in front of my 13-year-olds than I am here.
We act like
mine. No, they better not. Okay. So mine is more of a personal story that covers a lot more time. I've been in the education system in the state of Oregon since the 1970s. When I began my career in education, part of my compensation included medical benefits. I was impressed with the fact that as a young professional, I didn't have to worry about my medical costs. When my friends entered other professions and bragged about the salaries they were earning, I could fall back on the fact that I had much better medical benefits, and I didn't have to worry about my family, my husband at the time. So I had the assurance that if something happened to me or my husband, that this it would be covered. As I added children, my insurance took care of us during some major medical situations. I could put all of my energy into my job and not have to worry about daily medical needs or a catastrophe of some sort. Throughout the 70s, 80s, and into the early 90s, my coverage was fully paid as part of my benefit package, and it truly was good coverage. It took us through major hospitalizations for my children, as well as two open heart surgeries and two angioplasties for my husband. In addition to feeling needed in my profession as a teacher of the children of Oregon, I felt no financial need to look elsewhere to help support my family. Unfortunately,
If we could ask questions, we have your written testimony.
Sure.
And we've spent the last couple of days getting a better feel for and a better understanding of just the problems that your colleague and Ms. Smith presented. And,
yes.
And I see, in terms of your family's story here, which is pretty compelling, just reading through it earlier, what about a pool? Because I think there's universal agreement that the healthcare system we have and the price increases are unsustainable. So what about a pool is enticing to you as someone that's out actually in the trenches working for our children every day? And I guess what about that interests you to get up early and come to Salem and let us know how you feel?
Actually, this isn't early for me. I arrive at school about 6:30 every morning. Actually, the pool is of great interest to me because it gives us greater buying power. We can have better coverage with less dollars. At the present time, our coverage is going down, our benefits are going down, and the costs are going up, and the gap is becoming greater. Mm-hmm. And at this rate, I'm too old, as we were talking about the aging, to change my profession at this time. I'm 53 years old. I'm one of the aging people. Although medical catastrophes, by the way, happen to the young. My husband was 34 when he had his first open heart surgery. He was a runner, a non-smoker, and a very healthy young man. Mm. Okay, so this pool could help the coverage here. It could help all of us. I work with some young teachers, two of whom are leaving this year. They're wonderful educators, and they're leaving because they can't afford to stay. And it's a pretty sad state of affairs when my daughter, who's 27 and works at Intel, very well educated, would like to stop her job there and enter the education force. And I'm saying, do you really know what you're doing? Do you know what you're getting into? Do you know what's happening to the benefits in the public education? Hmm. And do you think you'll be able to support yourself? And I think if we could get those benefits back in some sort of reasonable range, I understand, and I think we all do, that medical costs have gone up. But our insurance rates keep going. I paid $214 out of pocket for my coverage. 4 years ago, I didn't pay anything. But 4 years ago, I had far superior coverage. And now I'm picking and choosing. The HMO has been dropped. Even the top insurance plan in my district is not sufficient. My cost, when I put here $500 a month out of pocket, that is the very minimum that I pay out of pocket. It doesn't include any co-pays for a doctor's visits, or if my husband has the semblance of a heart attack and he goes to the emergency room, which he should in that case. We pay a horrible co-pay now because he's not admitted sometimes. Sometimes they can treat him there and send him home. And so we're penalized for that, for not being able to have him stay overnight and make more, it costs more. And so I feel like if we're going to keep our, not just our young educators, but our educators that are in their mid lives and with their children, I'm afraid we're going to lose an immense amount of experience and passion. One of the young teachers leaving this year has an incredible passion for children, and it breaks my heart that she's leaving. But in the end, I have to tell her, do what's best for your family.
Mm-hmm.
And if we could take this bill and put us into a larger pool, I really think it could benefit both the state and the public employees.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
No, that's a very good answer. We're very aware of the statistics on retaining teachers once they enter the profession and other school employees and the retention rate, and it frightens us to see the attrition that you see in the first 2 years of how many get out of the profession right away, a chosen profession. Other questions? Yes, Senator George.
I'm really curious, that teacher that's thinking about leaving, where could they go to any other kind of employment that would have the benefits that even remain today? Right, where could they equal that?
One of the young people is going to go back to school and has an opportunity to pursue a career in law. Other people that I have known of, not this year, are entering the medical field. They're going back for radiology. They're going back for their RN. There are many other professions. Now, if they don't seek extra education, maybe not. But like we tell the children of our state, the more educated you are, the better cared for you are in the end. And they are seeking to go elsewhere. And yes, there are places where you don't get the benefits. Okay, another personal thing. My son, when he came out of high school 2 years ago, didn't want to go on to college. Very bright. He scored the highest score in the state of Oregon on math problem solving and SIM. Very bright child. Did not want to go on for education. He worked at Taco Bell for a year. And at the end of that year, he came to me and said, Mom, I want to go to school. Okay? He is in his training now to become a radiologist. There are professions, there are ways, okay, in the private industry. My daughter that I said worked at Intel has excellent benefits. She pays nothing for them. Okay? I'm not saying we shouldn't pay something. I'm just saying that it's becoming out of reach. My lifestyle has changed because of this, and I do not have an extravagant lifestyle. We're comfortable, but it definitely has changed. And the fact that my husband chooses not to take a medication because it's not life-threatening at this point is very upsetting to me. Okay, but that's his choice. Okay, that is his choice. But the fact that the insurance company has decided that even though he has mitigating circumstances and he can't take the other medication, the benefits have just decreased. We used to be able to have that choice and be covered. We do not have that choice anymore. Hopefully we will age as gracefully as many in the United States have been able to. And hopefully the educators in the state of Oregon will be valuable enough that we can choose this pool and get the good coverage back that we used to have.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, please.
I think she can handle those seventh graders.
may I answer the question also?
Sure.
I know that in Lebanon, our starting salary is about $29,000 a year, and I know that many of our students go out and get jobs that actually are $5,000, $10,000, or $15,000 more than we as a college-educated bachelor's, master's degree. We come in with a huge amount of debt to school normally, and then we're also going to be paying $2,000 or more out of pocket for our insurance premium, which brings our actual salary down to about $25,000 a year. So people within the first 5 years who are dropping out at 50% rate, they can significantly increase their amount of money that they earn, as well as probably get at least some benefit for their health care wherever they go, even if it's not as much. But the decrease in the actual out-of-pocket money buying force is more significant in the private sector.
Other questions for the panel? Thank you very much.
I would just like to add very quickly that I really enjoy teaching the children as well.
Ah, definitely.
You wouldn't be there if you didn't. Mr. Repeat of performance, Mr. McCann, Mr. Wilson, and Mr. Kevin McMartin.
(Clears throat)
members of the committee, and Mr. Chair Deckert. My name is Kevin McCann, Executive Director of the Oregon School Boards Association. Thanks for the opportunity to testify again. We merely wanted to clear up a couple of questions as best we can that were raised yesterday.
And no, Kevin McCartan?
He is not with our group, so.
Okay, then we'll have you. I thought you were. Thank you.
Three questions we want to cover. One about the five-year history of premium increases with PEB and OSBA, and you'll be getting this data here momentarily. Another question is on retention charges and administrative costs for OSBA's trust and for PEB. And the third question was about the Minnesota study that was testified to yesterday. The first point on premium increases, you can see that over the last 5 years from 2001 through 2004-05, the cumulative increase in rates, in premium rates for the two organizations, OSBA totaled 56.8% increase, PEB 74% increase. And this data came from PEB and, of course, our tracking. So that gives you a good indicator, and you can see year by year what happened to each of the programs. And I might point out, too, that they started out back in 2000 with premiums very close to each other. OSBA was at $474 and PEB was at $470.
Did, Mr. McCann, do you know, did OSBA trust, and you may not know, this, spend from its reserves this last year to keep the premium percentage down?
No, good question, Senator Deckert. No, it did not.
Did not, okay.
Correct. Point number two about retention and administrative costs. Again, you can see a comparison there. The big part of administrative cost goes to, in this case, PEB and OSBA use Regents as their carrier. And you can see that OSBA's Regents retention, it's called, which is really their cost for running the program, doing claims, underwriting, all that, 6.14%. of premium, and PEB was 6.60%. Again, very close. And the other pieces of that are other things. For example, an individual case in disease management is a program that's designed to take to identify the highest cost patients, those hit with chronic illness or catastrophic events, and help them manage their case better so they become healthier and less costly. OMIP is the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool that all insurance carriers are required to pay into. Portability costs has to do with those covered and when they leave from one plan and go to another. And then the last item is the what we talked about, what OSBA has called an endorsement fee, where as Mr. Pruitt testified yesterday on our behalf, that the OSBA insurance trustees provide a fee to the Oregon School Boards Association that's then plowed back into services to local school boards.
On that one, do you know how many other school boards associations operate with a royalty fee to fund their operations?
Yes. In a recent survey, 29 out of 46 associations that responded to the survey nationally have some sort of endorsement fee. There was also a question raised yesterday, is it a percentage, is it a flat fee? It varies from state to state.
It does. And is anywhere, is it 60%? Of, do you know, up to 60% of the whole operating budget?
There are a number of them. The latest study I saw was 03, and there were Oregon was among five others that I believe that are in that range. And I haven't seen the full scale of all of them, but
so we were in the top five, but there was four others that were in our range of
Texas. I'd have to go back and look, and I didn't bring that with me, but yes, there's other states in that similar situation.
Great.
And then the last box on page one shows the actual dollar amount when you take that for OSBA, for example, 0.8%. The number you see there for OSBA is a budgeted amount of $2.45 million, and we actually anticipate that will come in slightly below that for this current year because we've had some attrition from our programs during this current year.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, oops, please.
Excuse me, 2.38.
2.38.
Right.
Senator Dorsey.
We're looking at endorsement fee, and then I'm looking back at the bill, and I realize that, you know, that this could take up to 2% and place it just to run the supervising portion. When you look at that and you think, well, okay, all these administrative activities have to take care of. We have to deal with the case and disease management. We have to put all these other things back in there. When you think about this, it appears that we might actually be adding to costs, not reducing costs. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think there is, I guess, a couple of ways to answer that. You can look at the data and show that in a lot of ways, OSBA and PEB, which is really the best comparison, are quite similar. With the authority to go up, you could increase costs. In our program, we know that in terms of employees who help run our program, it's somewhere around 2 FTE. We know that PEB has 17 employees. But you also have to acknowledge when you're looking at this wall-to-wall that there are a lot of other costs in the entire system. If you think about all state employees who are covered by PEB, there are people in the state agencies and local offices that help coordinate and sign people up and all of that. And we have some of that, too, in the local school districts. So there's always a potential to drive up costs by doing some of these changes. If you want to make that comparison, what we use ours for in part is to pay for the roughly 2 FTE that we have assigned working on our program.
So with, I'm just kind of on that point,
sure.
You may not concede this point, but I hope you might at least concede this one, is that if you look at the 17 employees at PEB, it's just on your question, Senator George, do you think it's a fair assumption that there are more folks out there in the, with the dispersed system that we have administering health plans than the 17 and maybe the few others that are out there, FTE state employees, that there are far more, I think, remembering back 2 years ago, we had it in the hundreds, of that are out in the school districts, the 198 school districts implementing these plans. You may not concede that, but do you think it's a fair statement that you probably would be able to achieve at least fewer people administering health plans if you move to a statewide central pool?
Well, let me answer that from personal experience. I worked at Oregon State University for 19 years, and, of course, we were members of the state's system of insurance. I know there are a lot of people out there, and what's really difficult to get a handle on, at OSU, big agency, a lot of employees, it wasn't one or two people where compared to the same number of employees out in, you know, 50 or 100 school districts, you get the same employee mix. But there are a number of employees that work on filling out the right forms, getting people enrolled, getting them unenrolled, and then there's a centralized system. So I'm not sure I would concede that point. And I would also, just for the record, say it'd be very difficult to go out and count that accurately. I think both systems probably could generate some efficiencies that do not now exist. And one of the,
gives no ground.
One of the keys, frankly, is online enrollment. The technology that schools and the state have for enrolling people and managing the data, that creates a lot of efficiencies. And I think we're both struggling to make that as good as it could possibly be.
We did do a count, and Senators, I'm coming.
Okay.
We did do a count 2 years ago, and it was not a formal because we could never get the formal numbers. But we certainly, when we started counting in the school districts that we were interacting with of who was operating, managing for each school district, we at least, that was one of the quick things our work group was able to rule in favor of, is that you would be able to get some definitely FTE savings. Senators.
Thank you. And this perfect lead-in for the second question, and that is, I'm reading the Regency Blue Cross letter to us, and in this they start off by saying, yeah, we can do things. We do need to have savings. We need to look at every option in order to bring a system that is going to deliver, you know, benefits to our employees at the lowest cost. But they also, as you get towards the back of this letter, they make an interesting statement, and that's what I want to ask you about. They said the assumptions and the data and the savings projected by the proponents of the bill should not be proven through an untested experiment, which is what this would be. And they recommend that we take this bill and we turn it into a legislative task force that will actually go out and look at the structural changes, that would go out and try to establish, you know, what kind of contracts are possible out there. What is your opinion on taking that approach? In other words, we have battling numbers, and the best way to resolve that might be to move that direction.
I think, Chair Deckert, Senator George, that that's a very good point. And you all know as well as we do how complex the healthcare system is in this state and in this nation. And for anyone to attempt to compare two different plans is really, really difficult because of all the different systems. And even looking as an example, Minnesota versus Oregon, as we talked about yesterday, those are two very complex and in some ways very different systems. And so it's hard to compare them accurately. Really, I've been told by several people that are professionals in this business of actuarial study that if you really want to find out, the only true way to find out is to actually put together a plan, a healthcare plan, what are your coverages and all that, and put it out to have vendors bid on it or do the calculations. That's really the only way. And one of the points that I think helps prove that is if you look at the data on page one here, relative to administrative costs, why would it be that the administrative costs for OSBA are different than PEB at all? But yet they are, and that's not unusual. All plans are bid differently, and the sort of the dynamics and the hydraulics of the different pieces of the system create different reactions by those who provide the insurance. So that's why it's so difficult to actually come up with a fair comparison without actually bidding it. And that's one of the challenges I think we all have.
And your predecessor did sit on a, I don't know if it was termed a task force, but Representative Morgan called a group into place, and it was more exhaustive than any, including chairing a committee on tax reform that met seven times all over the state and logged well over 100 hours circling the state on tax reform. The group that I sat on that Representative Morgan had and your predecessor was on, though not officially deemed a task force, definitely spent 6 months studying before filing this legislation. And I'm forgetting your predecessor's
Chris
name.
Chris Dudley?
Mr. Dudley did sit on that task or that group. Yeah, Senator George.
But did they move to that next step, and that is to actually say we're going to move forward, we're going to solicit the bids, and ask for proposals? And I see they had nodding. No, they did not.
I don't believe they did.
No, where they landed was a skeptical look at the issue. I mean, I walked in a skeptic. Looking at the issue, filed a bill that the savings were at least large enough and significant enough that to not move forward. Just and that it was filed late, I believe June or July in the session of a long session, but it took us that long to really land on this is worth filing a bill and moving forward because the upside was so great and the downside seemed to be, other than OSBA, opposition just did not seem to be significant enough to not move forward. But Mr. Dudley was very, very active in his objections to that action. We got you off point.
Okay, third point merely is in relation to the study, the Minnesota study that was referred to yesterday. We provided a little more written information right off of a website. And a couple of points. One is that the Minnesota bill that was proposed did not pass, and an actuary back there said that they were targeting 5.3% for administrative costs, and you can see the comparisons with PEB and OSBA. He called it wishful thinking, and it would be hard for us to imagine, based on what we know, that we could improve even a percent of that administrative cost. It doesn't sound like that is a big number, but it is. The other thing that was discussed in Minnesota is that, as we pointed out yesterday, there are winners and losers created in this, and there will be school districts that end up paying more, and that puts them in a very difficult position. And then nothing in the bill requires or pushes for really getting at the cost drivers. As we said yesterday, the cost drivers are what they are, and creating a bigger pool does not necessarily get at those. The testimony earlier today, I have to say that if you think about it, school boards started providing insurance for their employees, as most private employers too, many, many years ago, because we all do know that healthier and happier employees are more productive. And the dynamics of this are such that with these costs going out of control, school board members, I can assure you, do not want to cut benefits. They do not want to, in an ideal world, they would not want to shift costs to employees. So we're with you on that. We've got to find ways to corral this so we can stop that trend. It is not healthy for any of us on the employee or the employer side. And then finally, the future trends of health insurance costs will not, the trend of costs going up, that's not going to be impacted by creating a larger pool. As I said yesterday, pools are a good thing. They do provide some efficiencies of scale, but creating a bigger pool than what exists in the market, we don't believe will actually impact that trend in and of itself.
Thank you very much. Just one question on your second to last point. And I would absolutely agree that it is not an appetizing decision when you have to cut benefits or shift costs onto employees. A position OSBA took this session that surprised me, it was counter to previous positions OSBA has taken, is just on school funding. And I don't have to give you the statistics of where we've dropped from being in the, even when I was in high school, which I don't hark back too often, but we were in the top 10 to 15 states in the nation, and obviously through the 90s and early 2000s, we've slipped to 1,000 less per pupil, and certainly that affects what school boards can do on health care, that sliding. And so I was surprised when I heard OSBA actually favored a lower school funding number from the state and endorsed a lower school funding, and it seems to it would hurt if that second point is... Did I get wrong? Or
I am absolutely, Senator Deckert, baffled. I mean, I guess I, on one level, I do understand how people conclude what they conclude. We do not support a lower number. $5.4 billion, which seems to be the top number that is talked about in this building in the environment in which you're working, does not address adequacy for schools in Oregon, period. It does not do it. We have evidence with the quality ed model of what it would really take. We know how far a reach that to get to that is, but 5.4 does not do it for us. And it, I know part of the dilemma was that John Marshall, our lobbyist, was quoted in the Oregonian, and they made it appear as if he was saying that somewhere around 5.2 or whatever the number was in that article was good enough. It's not.
Did he not say that?
He had a 45-minute conversation about that topic, and I think I was not there, but I'm told that he gave a lot of context and as to the discussions you all have about budget numbers and why they come out where they are, and I think he was quoted on something that people assumed. And by the way, while we are on this topic, if you'll give me a moment, when the governor came out recently with his number of 5.25, we would have been more than happy to say the trend is going in the right direction if we're looking at a higher number.
I appreciate, yeah, Senator Pozanski.
One thing else, I guess, come to say the defense or whatever it might be, I had one superintendent said that when the 5.0 number was out there, the formula that was there for that number gave them more money into their school district than the new number under a new formula. And I don't sit here and say I understand exactly what the changes were, but that individual superintendent said that they were actually going to see potentially $90,000 difference between the numbers. So it's not necessarily just the number, which of course we need the number. We need to make sure that whatever the formula is going to be isn't changed each time you change the number, because you may be actually taking away where it appears that someone's getting more.
We have Mr. Formula seated to my right here, and so any changes that are made to the school funding formula, you'll see Steve here and a bill in front of us, they would come through here. So we can reassure him on that, is that we haven't made any changes yet that I know of, Steve, in the school funding corner. Other questions for our panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. Inga Nelson and Mr. McCartan, please come up. And Ms. Nelson, if you'd like to come up, and then we'll. And I understand you not didn't come together.
But we bring them together.
But we bring people together. Not on this one, we don't, though.
We try.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Please go ahead and we'll let.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good morning, Senators. My name is Kevin McCartan of McCartan Analytical Services. My professional background includes 28 years in the healthcare financing field. For 20 years, I've worked for underwriters of our healthcare financing system, primarily through the Blue Cross Blue Shield system and Kaiser Permanente. My experience has not only been in the state of Oregon, but you'll probably hear or pick up on my New England accent somewhere through my presentation, but I have experience back on the other coast.
The Red Sox.
The Red Sox, yeah, quite the year. I held senior management level positions with each of these organizations, all within the actuarial underwriting statistical analysis sciences. For the past 8 years, I've worked primarily as a consultant to group purchases of healthcare in both fully insured and partially self-funded models. I work daily with employers, both public and private, here in Oregon, on strategies to reduce the rate of growth in their employee benefit plan costs. Much of your earlier conversations and testimony, those are issues that every employer, both public and private, are grappling with, and there are no easy answers. I appreciate the committee affording me the time to express my viewpoints on the proposed Oregon Education Benefit Board that is created through Senate Bill 639. I've seen several different estimates of annual savings that range between $20 to $50 million. When I have pressed for the source of these savings, I am told that the larger economies of scale will drive down fixed costs. I would like to explore with you this morning where these possible savings could come from, okay, and leave it to your own sources to decide whether some of these savings are real, okay, or have a high probability or low probability of being achievable.
And you're here on your own accord, Mr. McCartney?
I am here on my own accord.
Just representing yourself.
That's correct.
Great, thanks.
Yeah. Administrative savings. It is true that aggregating enrollment in a larger purchasing block will reduce fixed costs. However, to my knowledge, OSBA, OEA, and OSEA presently all offer coverage through existing purchasing pools. And from the prior testimony given, you can see that the administrative expenses on the OSBA plan are less than 8%. I don't know how you save 5 percentage points of 8 percentage points by moving to a pool. Okay, so some of the economies of savings are already existing in some of the purchasing pools that already exist in the state. Although I do not know the actual administrative expense of these pools, some economies of scale are already reflected in their premium rates. Premium tax. I've seen references made to premium tax reductions. However, all of the above three programs that I've mentioned above are actually written by domiciled Oregon companies, okay, where premium tax really doesn't apply. Okay, depending upon how OEBB would contract with carriers and reinsurers, premium tax may become an additional cost. Okay, if OEBB contracts with an out-of-state carrier that's not domiciled, there's a new cost that would come into the plan, which would be premium tax. The next item is in risk charges. Okay, references to reduction in risk charges required under a fully insured plan have been referenced. If OEBB is to contract with a carrier under a fully insured contract, there are limited savings on these charges. If OEBB intends to partially self-fund, then these risk charges could be reduced. However, partial self-funding raises the issue of available contingency reserves if OEBB actual experience is greater than expected. Okay, the predictability in healthcare is one that you can look at the largest organizations in the state, and they don't hit it on the nose every year. There are some years where they have significant financial losses, and then followed by some years where they try to recover from those losses. Insured carriers include risk charges in their rates in order to maintain surplus reserves at an appropriate level that is monitored by the Oregon Insurance Department. For a group the size of OEBB, a surplus margin equivalent to 10% of annual premium is used as the minimum threshold. Okay. Where will OEBB get the initial funding to establish such a minimum surplus threshold? Again, these are questions I'm posing if the partial self-funding route is the route that OEBB would pursue. What happens if actual costs exceed the premium funding received? Will a general fund have to be used to bail out that deficit? Okay, I think that's a serious issue I haven't heard a lot of discussion about. Portability. Another issue associated with partial self-funding revolves around portability. Fully insured customers have portability rights that partially self-funded customers do not have. Due to the fact that individuals that select to exercise their portability rights normally consume health care at a rate higher than the premiums charged, fully insured carriers need to assess their clients for the subsidy this requirement generates. And you can see on the exhibit that the prior individuals provided, there is a line there that it talks about region's portability cost, and it ranges between approximately 0.2% and 0.5% under PIP. That is a subsidy charge to cover the cost of the expenses that are greater than the premiums for those individuals who participate in the portability plans. Now, will OEBB members lose their portability rights? If not, has this cost been included in the savings generated? I've also heard some discussions about pooling and stop-loss premiums. So let me just kind of give you a real quick snapshot of what those terms mean. This type of coverage caps the risk for an individual claimant at some specified dollar limit, okay, and that's referred to as an attachment point. Okay, savings can be achieved by increasing the attachment point to a higher dollar level. For instance, if it's your attachment point is $50,000 now and you move to $250,000, the premium for that policy is less. But the cost between the $50,000 and $250,000 gets shifted to the entity. So if a claim did occur between those thresholds, the OEBB would be responsible for that liability. My experience with fully insured plans written by domiciled Oregon carriers is that for larger groups of 1,000 or more enrollees, the local carrier rates are generally more competitive than reinsurers for similar attachment points. So again, I don't see a lot of savings going to be generated from pooling or stop-loss premiums. The next point is OEBB administrative costs. I haven't heard any discussion regarding the 2% available funding for the operations. Has this been included in the estimate? And the last point that I would make is on contribution caps. And I think this was referenced in some earlier testimony where in many entities, both public and private, employers have already instituted a cap on what they will contribute on a monthly basis to premiums. Okay, and in many instances, employees are given the choice that here's a plan that meets that cap, but if you choose to purchase a higher benefit plan, you pay the difference. Okay, so those are employee contributions. Any savings that will be generated by this pool, the first dollars of savings would go back to those individual employees. Now, I'm sure they would appreciate that savings, but the key is those aren't savings that will be generated and accrued down to the state level. Okay, they will be savings that those first dollars of savings will accrue back to individuals. Where this leads me is the uncertainty with the above issues raises concerns about the savings that could be generated. Okay, without clear answers to these questions, I would hesitate to turn over more than $400 million of annualized premium to a state monopoly that eliminates all existing competitors. Okay, so a recommendation or another point to look at. Maybe a better approach would be to allow the state to develop and offer plans under the same rules applied to other competitors. Okay? Then, if the savings are real, more districts would tend to migrate to the state plan, and state contributions could be limited to OEBB premium levels. Thank you for your time and interest in my comments.
Thank you, Mr. McMartin. I hope the road work on Olson Road. I see you're from Olson Road.
Yes, that's correct.
In my area.
Mm-hmm.
I hope the road work does not impact you negatively.
Well,
the biggest issue facing Beaverton and Southwest Portland, the history of...
Well, there's a will, there's a way, so we find back roads around that center.
I've got some good routes for you.
Good. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. McMartin? Ms. Nelson. Did you?
What was it?
Ms. Nelson.
Thank you. Chair Deckert, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Inga Nelson with the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon. We represent K-12 classified employees, community college faculty and classified employees, and higher education faculty in Oregon. I am testifying today on behalf of our K-12 classified employees and our community college employees, all of whom are potentially impacted by this legislation. I also submitted some written testimony for Rob Wagner, who is our Director of Political and Legislative Affairs. We enthusiastically support Senate Bill 639 with the Dash 5 amendments. And we also echo OSEA's comments regarding the opponent's arguments. As a number of educational advocates across the country are realizing, pooling school district employees for health insurance purposes is one of the best options we have available to us at this time to help contain rising health care costs. Definitely isn't a fix-all. There is a greater problem out there that we need to look at. But Senate Bill 639 with the Dash 5 amendments does have a number of points that we fully support. Healthcare costs have become the number one issue at the bargaining table, and shifting costs to employees and reducing benefits is simply exacerbating our statewide and nationwide healthcare crisis. As Mr. Carlson presented yesterday, this bill is likely to save the state at least $182 million, which would free up dollars to support or move towards supporting adequately funding education in Oregon. Our local school districts will retain the ability to negotiate costs, cost sharing, and plan options. And specifically, the plan, this bill provides that plan options will be provided so that school districts aren't forced to choose plans that cost more than what they're currently providing. We also support the provision that provides a very minimal opt-out language because, as was mentioned yesterday, if this isn't primarily mandatory, the cost savings do seem to go away. And so we do, however, support the limited opt-out for those districts that are self-insured or that have independent trusts. And for these basic reasons, we urge you to support Senate Bill 639 with the Dash 5 amendments.
Thank you. Yes, Senator George, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm reading from the Minnesota School Boards Association analysis of what they plan to do, which actually did get stopped. One of the things they talk about was the fact that they believe that, in fact, would end up in a situation in which their employees, their staff, would end up with less benefits because of caps and things like that. And I'm thinking about the experience of the U.S. with Medicare and Medicaid and what happened, the promises were made, and the fact that they don't deliver, 50-60% of actual costs. Coming down to the Oregon Health Plan and the promises were made, and actually now we're just going down through whacking units of coverage. And are you afraid at all, either one of you, that we'll end up in that same situation, that we may, in fact, escalate costs and we'll start to cut benefits in order to keep this within a manageable range?
Senator and Mr. Chair, let me take a stab at that one. I think that we will continue to see medical inflation rise at a rate faster than general inflation. Look back at history, and history tells us that that has happened 50 straight years. It's going to be the degree to which that gap continues to boom. Now, the past 5 years of cost shifting to the marketplace that we're dealing with has been primarily due to two major items in my eyes. One is just continued increase in medical technology. We have an unending appetite for new technology, and it serves a very good social benefit to each of us as individuals. I mean, we all want the best for ourselves and our loved ones. I'm not sure anyone would stand up and say no to that. But the other one is the balanced budget amendment from Medicare that has resulted in a huge cost shift to the private pay marketplace. So where will cost, will this bill address the major drivers of cost? No. We are tinkering with the 10% of the pie, and the 90% is where premiums are going to go. So the expectation of any pool that you establish here that will hold rates down to general inflation, I think, is a false hope. I do not believe that that will continue, and we're going to have to find ways to grapple with migrating over a shorter period of time to how each of us shares in that escalation in cost. And I think that's where the whole movement in consumer-directed health plans is headed, and I think it's one that's out of the bond and on its way.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. Chair.
No, I was just thinking.
Mr. McCart, in your testimony, you talked about larger groups of 1,000 or more pool. Can you tell us from your experience, if the pool is larger, I mean, the larger the pool, is there more realization of savings in the sense of you have 1,000 versus 10,000 versus 20,000 on up? Do you see where that size would actually make any type of difference in what type of rates would be available?
Well, I think from the standpoint of fixed cost, you reach a point of limiting return. My guess is somewhere around 5,000 to 10,000 employees. I mean, as you begin to grow beyond that, do you get a much bigger savings? I don't believe so. I mean, in much smaller groups, and you normally see groups of 50 and below are the ones who like to accumulate in big pools because they can avoid, and sometimes 10% of some fixed overhead costs that they get treated as a group of 1,000 employees versus, you know, 20 groups of 50 employees. So I think you accumulate to a point that the you have a diminishing return on what the savings are there. That's why my perspective is that why cut down on the number of pools that are operating in a competitive marketplace? Okay, if you don't gather much more savings by accumulation of 50,000 versus those of 5 to 10, why not promote multiple pooling options that direct folks at their own choice to programs that are trying to pass on the same economies of scale?
Mr. Chairman, can I follow up on a question?
Please.
When you look at this bill, don't you think it just eliminates any possibility that we'll ever achieve medical savings accounts, which actually puts that person back in charge?
Senator, I'm not sure I see this as a deterrent in that way, unless the structure of the OEB board, we've got this unknown entity out there that we don't know what the philosophy and viewpoints will be on whether consumer-directed health plans are something that should be left on a different planet or should be an endorsed product and leave that up to the consumers to purchase. So, but I don't see this bill as itself being a deterrent. I think as it evolves, it would be more of a philosophical approach.
Mr. Chairman, he just hit my point, and that was the point that we're going to have a board that's going to come in with a philosophical bent. They may be very open to competition and innovation, and they may not. And we already have experience in which we have a board that's making those kind of decisions that is limiting opportunities for innovation in healthcare. So, and that's just my opinion, and thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
We did have the work group, and I don't mean to keep referring to it, but we did have people in your field, Mr. McMartin, I forget the firm from Seattle, but we tried to find an independent body outside of Oregon that were in the same field as yourself that would answer some of those questions. And on the medical savings account, their opinion, at least given to us, although this is dated, it's a year and a half old now, or 2 years, was that in some ways it would hone the conversation in one place, where you could actually have a fuller and deeper conversation. You may disagree with that. And then on the second point, they at least expressed to us, to the point of certainly giving us much more interest, was that the size of the pool gives you better leverage when you're negotiating deals with insurance companies. It just gives you, and I don't know if your clients are insurance companies, and so this might be a tough one to put to you, but it does. I mean, they were pretty emphatic that, yes, the size of the pool gives you better leverage, just as reason would go, that they're going to be interested in 40,000, 80,000, 90,000. That's more lives and more coverage. If you care to comment on that.
I would love to comment on that, Mr. Chairman. I work primarily for purchasers. I do dabble once in a while on some ad hoc projects to help health plans, and they normally bring me in as an outside representative that says, are we on base with where the marketplace is headed? But I'm not sure many health plans view me as their best friend because I'm trying to shake, some of them say, try to shake nickels and dimes out of their pocket on behalf of my customers. I believe there's a fallacy in the thinking that the bigger you are, the more you can beat up on your health plan partner, okay, and squeeze dollars beyond the point that they can actually operate. Especially a pool this big, I think one of the issues that hasn't been raised that on a fully insured basis, for a carrier to write this plan at $400 million annual premium, just to throw out a ballpark number, in meeting that 10% contingency reserve requirement that I spoke to you about that the state imposes, okay, for good reasons. I mean, that is a safety net to make sure that the promise of people who purchase those policies, the dollars are there when their need comes, is they have to have $40 million in excess surplus. There's only a handful of carriers in this state that meet that criteria. So you're not going to have a lot of competition if you try and put this under one health plan, okay, with one entity. So I don't know. I believe there's a fallacy in how far you can push the agenda on that piece. Now, the other side of the equation that we haven't discussed today that is a very large concern for me, okay, is you accumulate all of this purchasing power under one umbrella. Does the state then go out and try and negotiate their own fee schedule with hospitals, physicians, and pharmaceutical companies? And many, I'm sure, in the audience and outside will say, yeah, that's exactly what they should do. Well, my fear on that is then all you've become is another Medicare and Medicaid. Okay, we're going to shift more costs. We're going to create greater access issues to those who aren't in the state-run pools or in Medicare and Medicaid. And that's the problem we're suffering today with the major acceleration in premiums for the past 5 years. So hopefully this approach doesn't move in that direction.
Mm-hmm. One question I had for you, Ms. Nelson, is in your testimony, you cite an OSBA memo to the governor, and I don't know if it's public, but if you had it, that is, in their words, estimating $74 million in savings. I think it'd be to benefit the committee to see if you do have that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, Rob put that together, and I don't have that right with me, but I can sort of find out from him where it is and make sure that you get a copy of it.
We'd like to see it. I mean, if Beth Ann's waving, well, all the proponents are now waving.
I guess they have it.
it would give OSBA a chance or at some point to refute if it was in there. Mm-hmm. In the writing memo. Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Chuck Bennett, Kent Hunsicker from COSA. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. At the outset, Mr. Chairman, so it's clear where we're coming from, we're opposed to the bill, and including the Dash 5 amendments don't improve it for us. I want to kind of go to because I think the fact situation has been laid out, and if you're to weigh the facts, I think the bill's clear. Now, if you go to other belief systems and things, you can arrive at another place. But in listening to the fact situation, it seems clear to us that the savings proposed by the proponents of the bill remain questionable. And I think you only have to listen as the discussion has gone on to really hear how tenuous this is. And I think even read the bill to see how tenuous the hold on this savings proposal are. There, the terms I heard yesterday and today are hopefully, if, and maybe when you talk about the savings. In fact, the bill itself incorporates that kind of language by proposing that the savings may not occur, and if the savings don't occur, we'll hold certain districts harmless. It proposes it by limiting the number of school districts that would be included in the pool, by exempting our state's largest school district from participation in the pool because it has a union trust, which we could go into the reason for that, but we can't figure out in the spirit of the bill and the bringers of the bill why that would be. Four districts are exempted. And two of them are some of our largest districts, Medford, North Clackamas, Albany, Crook County, because they're self-insureds. And again, I think it's a question of why would they, in fact, as I recall, North Clackamas has the highest rates in the state at this point for health insurance and yet is exempted from this bill. And again, it arrives, I think, at the hopefully maybe if nature of the savings that are suggested here.
Mr. Bennett, if they were brought in, would you be supportive of the bill?
No, Mr. Chairman, because it remains hopefully maybe an if. And I think the bottom line is the proposal for a task force that, and I think it's in the words of the bill, we can go into the bill and take a look, but it's to take a look at if savings occur. There really is a question, a bottom line question. In fact, listening to the testimony, there's a $210 million swing between there won't be a savings and there will be a savings, and then you can go along that list of how much it could or may be. But what is difficult to understand, Mr. Chairman, is why there would not be, and I understand how much time was spent on this last session, but that there wouldn't be a task force, or as Mr. McCann suggested, an RFI that would occur to find out sort of once and for all, is there a savings incorporated in this kind of large pool? You get testimony on whether the pool is too large, whether there's savings in this kind of scope of bill, et cetera. Another thing I wanted to...
Can I ask just one more?
You bet.
Was the governor's office unclear? I'm trying to refresh from yesterday. If they were unclear that when they asserted a 5% savings, or the gentleman from Watson and Wyatt, was he? I didn't hear an if or an hope, but my hearing is really actually not that great, and so I might have misheard.
That's what I heard, Mr. Chairman. I did not hear certainty from the governor. I've listened to Mr. Sager present this before, and I have yet to hear a real guaranteed savings on this. Now, maybe my hearing is skewed by my opinion, and I certainly am subject to it like everyone else in the room is. And I'd be willing to listen again or listen to the tapes. But I think in aggregate, as you listen to the discussion, it is a real hopeful. And I think we're all hoping for it, that there would be a savings. But I think it would, to arrive at support for a bill like this, I think you'd have to be pretty certain there is going to be a savings. And I think that kind of gets to my next point, Mr. Chairman. This is not about a brand loyalty to OSBA. School districts don't have brand loyalty to OSBA and to their pool. In fact, districts come and go from the OSBA pool on a regular basis. There may be a dozen a year that move in or out of the OSBA pool trying to find alternative savings programs. So that is not where we're coming from. If there is a demonstrated savings, and it is substantial enough and guaranteed over time, the existing program with its safe harbor, with its availability of various programs, with the opportunity to self-insure in the future, et cetera, I think all of us would be willing to walk away from the OSBA pool looking for a better cost savings. That isn't the issue here. And Mr. Chairman, another issue that has come up, I just want to mention, it came up yesterday, and I've heard this analogy before, and I just wanted to respond to it, is the Fred Meyer analogy. It has intrigued me since I heard Max Williams use it last session, and I thought about it. Mr. Chairman, I racked my brain going back into the early 70s when I got involved in politics as a newspaper reporter, and trying to remember on each of the ballot measures that came along looking at funding alternatives for the public schools. Going back to, I recalled an interview I had with Jason Bowe about the Bowe-Eyman-McCall plan. It was interesting. At no point, including in the discussion of Measure 5, was there a suggestion that these bills were about a substantial reconfiguration of the governance system of Oregon schools, and certainly not, and this is my recollection again, that we're changing with Measure 5, which is the one that I think probably most applies here, to a subsidiary relationship between the couple hundred school districts and their elected school boards and the state. My recollection of Measure 5 was really a funding issue and a quality of taxation or preferability of taxation. I don't recall, and I guess I've never caught along the way, that the public had turned over their local control of their school districts to the extent that would be suggested by a subsidiary relationship. The other thing, I guess, is as you look at at Fred Meyer itself and the Kroger Corporation that owns it, what you find in Oregon, I'm not going to look, I mean, this is a Cincinnati-based corporation, I just didn't have time to take a look at all of it, but when you look at how they do health insurance in Oregon, they in fact aren't centralized. You have at Kroger a Kroger self-insurance program for their non-union employees. You have the Portland Health and Welfare Trust for their Portland area employees. And for employees south of Salem, you have the Joint Labor Management Trust. I mean, they have not centralized the pool. They, despite being a lot, if not the largest, at least one of the largest corporations in the country, have apparently ignored the intuitive reality of a single large pool, even in a state like Oregon. And I'm not looking at Washington and Idaho, and as you look at other states, how just diverse they
have. Don't, I don't want to make Max's point for them, but they don't have one purchasing group in their central office that makes, not that now Fred Meyer should be the model of how we design our healthcare system. But,
I hope not.
But I always bought the assertion that Representative Williams made at the time that they did have one group that actually did their negotiating on for their different plans, which is actually kind of what this bill basically sets up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you would be going well beyond my pay grade with the Kroger Corporation as we go into how they do it. I am just telling you the configuration looks a lot more like the way we do schools than it does some sort of centralized health system that I think was at least suggested by Max's comments. So, just to at least take a look at the analogy, I guess the other two, Mr. Chairman, is whether or not you all want to take on the responsibilities of a 90-member school board and want to take on all of those contracting relationships that would go on that at least I think logically can be drawn from this kind of policy conclusion, whether or not you should take on statewide collective bargaining and all the other issues associated with this kind of centralized school system. But that's not what the voters contemplated. And I think it really would take a much longer discussion to take it to the extreme that this could arrive at. Mr. Chairman, other than that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Hunsaker, to make any further comments. Thank you.
Morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kent Hunsaker. I'm the executive director for the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Just a couple of comments. I know you've had a lot of testimony. We have a coalition of school superintendents that looks at various issues. On two occasions, this coalition, which is 40 superintendents from across the state representing different sizes of districts, have opposed this legislation. And when you think about it, you would say to yourself, why would a group of superintendents oppose legislation that supposedly has 100, and I've heard different numbers, 180 million, 223 million, when it first came out, $100 million, $100 million in savings. And as simple as it gets, that decision-making is based on the current rates of PEB and OSBA. And if you look at those rates at the present time, the PEB rates are $75 a month higher than the OSBA rates. And there are many districts throughout the state that are doing things on their own that are even better than that. So as you look at school districts, they believe that the savings are speculative, that they're not guaranteed, and that there's not legitimate information out there that says that this is going to be a savings to them. School superintendents across the state are looking for options to save money. And they would embrace something that was guaranteed to save money. If we had a guarantee in this house, I would be here testifying in favor of this bill. We do not have a guarantee. We have speculation. The other point I wanted to make is that, as you know, I was a superintendent for a long time. My last superintendency was in the Bethel School District in Eugene. We were members of the OSBA pool. And we wanted to try and influence our insurance costs. One of the ways to do that is to get your own experience, to work with your employees, and to try and influence the claims experience of your school district through some type of a committee structure and involvement from your employees. We were fairly successful. We got out of the pool. We got our experience. We gathered the groups. They began looking at various things that we could do with our experience. And the reason I bring up that example is that I think it's a really important one, is that the bigger you get, the less that you have of employee involvement in trying to actually deal with the costs that are out there, the claims costs. And the ones that have been really successful, I've been visiting with a group of people about self-insuring, a larger pool of self-insuring districts. And as we looked at those, almost all of those people have genuinely involved their employees in the costs of insurance in the system. And so my worry is the bigger you get, the more you take that out of the system. And then I kind of wanted to second the third part of this, is that when we have a bill in front of us that limits, that takes out people for various reasons, and I actually felt the bill was better when it included everybody than the exempted ones, because it was going to save them. Why not have it a statewide thing? But until those savings are guaranteed, and the only way that you're going to be able to do that is to put your pool together, take it out and bid it, and show that the savings are true.
That's actually an interesting idea. So you would be supportive of, I mean, there's amendments being drafted on the second point, so I think that'll share, and Mr. Bennett mentioned that, in terms of the pool is the pool. So you would be supportive of this bill if it's enacted, but not fully enacted, that the first, there's bids on it being given, and that would garner your support, where you basically create, you have all the enacting legislation that is there, you do that, but you allow a process and a period of time for actually to have bidding occur. You would support the bill if we built in just a period of bidding into it to actually get some information from the market back. I'm glad to hear that. That's something I think we would consider.
And there would be savings. The savings would be there in reality, and it would not be enacted until the savings are proven. Is that how you would do it?
Yeah, I mean,
you have enacting legislation, but it's triggered by whether or not you really save money.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the whole purpose of, and I certainly don't want to speak for the person who chaired the group that actually brought this, but you had 10 or 11 people get together in a room and spend an incredible amount of time, more than I've done in my legislative experience, and all arrive a separate one who actually had a dog in the fight. All arrived at the same place. But yes, there's savings to be had here. This is an interesting concept. This is something. And so, I will note that would garner the support of COSA that enact the bill.
Let us see the amendments first. I think that's only fair. I think if you've got a trigger and you can't pull it without savings, yeah, you're starting to look at something serious. But so far, this is intuitive savings. This is speculative. And if you have something like that, we'd really like to take a look at it. If you've got something that really saves money and it's guaranteed, and by bidding it, you're able to prove it rather than the kind of speculation we keep hearing, yeah, that's a really interesting idea. But please don't tear apart an existing system. That's what worried me, I think, most about the idea of sunsetting this thing, would be to, well, if it doesn't work, we can just take it apart and go back to the old. You've torn apart a really successful system that's worked for 35 years that we believe it will continue to work. So we hope you're not headed that direction.
Yeah, the only point I would quibble with is the speculative nature. I mean,
no.
We sat there for hours and hours trying to decide whether it was speculative or not, and that's where we arrive that beyond speculation. Other questions for the panel?
Chair Deckard, I have one more comment about initial bids, too. I mean, when we, again, this is a single school district, when we initially went out and sought bids to replace our insurance, we did it without experience. So Folks knew what we were paying before. They bid. Their initial bid was lower. And then when we got a real experience, it was higher. And, you know, that's always the danger in the insurance business, is that you can even get bids in the beginning that are great. But the question is what will happen with your experience over time, and where will those costs go in the future? And I think that's, you know, that's...
I completely agree. I mean, it's the time savings that you're after.
Right.
We're going to lose our vice chair here, it looks like, to the floor. So thank you very much. Any other questions? The community colleges, this bill, I'd like to send it to Ways and Means today in the next 2 minutes. Community colleges would like in. I don't see them in the audience, and they have an amendment drafted that Senator Devlin, are having amendments drafted that Senator Devlin. Beth Ann, do you want to say two words on that? Or?
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, very quickly, a subsection that dealing with eligible employees that impacts community colleges was a Scribner's error and was inadvertently left off. It's sub D on Senate Bill 107, and it says, who is employed by a community college, or I'll read the whole, except as provided in paragraph A, big B of this subsection, eligible employee does not include an individual, and then the piece that was left off says, who is employed by a community college and is not included as an eligible employee under policies adopted by the Board of Education of the community college district or under a collective bargaining agreement. And with me is Lori Satenspiel from Oregon Community Colleges Association, and we will work together to have Senator Devlin fix this in the Ways and Means process.
Thank you. Close public hearing, open work session on Senate Bill 639. We have dash five amendments before us.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Please.
If we're going to send it to Ways and Means, where it's going to be further amended, should we just send the bill along with the amendment as opposed to having it printed and having it be reprinted again? I mean, it's up to you, Mr. Chair, but if it's going to be done again, I mean, they'll have the amendment before them. It's going to cost $1,000 to print it and then redo it again. Whatever you think.
Well, I don't.
I mean, if it was the final deal, then I think we amend it and send it down to them. But if it sounds like there's other amendments that are going to go into this bill.
Mm-hmm. We're all about savings, and so I would be... Yeah, no, we're posted for Thursday. I'm open. We could wait for Thursday. We have it posted Thursday. We could come back to it on Thursday if folks want to.
Is it your understanding that the bill will be further amended?
Yes, it is going to be further
amended. I just think we should just send in the bill and with the, we would like them to continue working on it with Senator Devlin and others.
Okay, so let's do that. That's fine. Let's we'll bring this back Thursday. We'll have the community colleges get their amendment, and it's posted for a work session on Thursday. And I know we have two senators who I believe are in opposition. So I am aware of
question.
That. Senator Brzezinski.
So we're going to bring it back Thursday, waiting for amendment, and then send everything down for them to have again a re-amend. I mean, if we're going to send it down, and let them deal with it and take it off our docket.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It was just send it to them.
That's what he said.
We have four votes on that
motion. Okay. Well, we have four votes. We're picking up votes on that. So you want to move the...
Yeah,
I mean, I'm fine with having them because it's technical. I mean, the dash two is just a Treasury technical amendment.
Sure, and I'm just saying they could do it all at once rather than have the printing office delay it. And
perfect.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 639 to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Metzger has moved Senate Bill 639 to the Committee on Ways and Means discussion. Yes, Senator Sharp.
I do strongly oppose this. I think it's speculative. If we do this thing, we're creating a very huge bureaucracy. We're, in fact, likely delaying the opportunity for health savings or medical savings accounts, which is, I think, a tremendous mistake. And so, Mr. Chair, I'll be voting against moving this bill out of committee.
Mr. Chair, if I just make it clear, that was with a due-pass recommendation on my motion.
Your motion.
Which I didn't say.
Mm-hmm. And just on Senator Starr's point, you have been
very clear, at least with me, for 2.5 years of your opposition from, I think, day one. The moment that you sat down in our work group that this is not a concept that you find yourself supportive of. Senator George, please.
Mr. Chairman, I came into this building, and we were encouraged by some of the districts that were responding in the same way. I was thinking, there's two ways you get money for school districts. You either raise taxes and give them more money, or you figure out a way for them to save. Now, what's happened to me relative to this bill is I've been very open to the idea, is it possible we could really have some savings here? But the conclusion that I've come to is that it cannot be proven, and that it is speculation. And so I would hope that we would recommend, we're going to recommend that this move be moved forward with a due pass, but I hope that they take a long look at this in ways and means and say maybe we would be better off with the task force to go out and solicit that, you know, that information and provide a real basis for decision.
Mm-hmm. I hear your comments. Senator Pruszynski.
Mr. Chair, I want to support the motion, but I'm also on the premise that it is going to be still a work in progress. And it appears to me that the Chair has brought up some points as to how we can actually maybe move it down the road, get it in a position where it could actually go into implementation if the trigger is right. I mean, in the sense that the savings are there and we're actually going to be able to benefit getting more money into the schools, classrooms, and taking the burden off of the teachers, as we've heard, I think that's something we should look at. But it, to me, based on what we got right now, it's definitely a work in progress, and maybe getting it down to Ways and Means where they can do their review and analysis will give us the clarity as to whether the savings are there or not.
Thank you. I'm incredibly biased on this, but I was in a spot similar to Senator George, and I think we spoke about this for a couple years. I can tell you that I'm convinced, became convinced, that there really is efficiencies to be had, the fixed costs, there really are savings to be had there. But I do think it's going to, well, I know it's going to be amended at its next stop. I think we assured that. More conversation or discussion. Senator Metzger has moved the bill unamended and with a due pass recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means. Barbara, please call the roll.
Senator George.
No.
Senator Metzger.
Aye.
Senator Pruszynski.
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr.
No.
Votes aye. The bill passes, and we are adjourned until no committee tomorrow, so until Thursday.
Oh, cool.
work session and adjourned.